Good evening. We ought to get started, I think. My name's Carton Rogers, and I'm the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries here at Penn. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the 2007 Rosenbach Lectures. This year's lecture series entitled Penn and Press, Practices of Writing and Publishing in Colonial America, begins this evening and will continue on Thursday at 5:30 and conclude on Monday the 26th, also at 5:30. All three lectures will be here in the Rosenwald Gallery and will be followed by a reception. I invite you to stay, to come actually to all three lectures and to stay for all three receptions. And take a look at the exhibitions that the library has up currently on this floor, The Art of Reinvention, Travel, Exile, and Recuperation, which is done in conjunction with the Penn Humanities Forum, is a particularly interesting exhibit. I'd like to thank my colleagues in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, Lynn Farrington, John Pollock, Andrea Gottschalk, and Dan Traster, for their efforts and support of this year's lectures, as well as Adam Corson-Finnerty, Chris Foley, and Kristen Winch from the Library's Development Office, my assistant, Adela Smith, and Alita Arthurs, the Library's Events Coordinator. To steal a phrase from somebody, it takes a village, and I appreciate all the efforts from my staff to make these lectures come off. Now, for those of you who aren't aware of the history of this event, the Rosenbach Lectures enjoy a long and honored tradition. In 1928, A.S.W. Rosenbach, the great American bookseller, donated $20,000 to the university to establish a fellowship in bibliography. Dr. Rosenbach's Philadelphia-based antiquarian bookselling firm dominated the rare book trade in a significant portion of the early 20th century. And he himself was the author of many standard reference works in bibliographical studies. In his letter of November 12, 1928, to then Provost Josiah Penniman, agreeing to create what we refer to today as an endowment fund, Dr. Rosenbach noted that, and I quote, "The increasing interest in bibliography warrants such an appointment, and I believe it would be also of material advantage to the library of the university and all other libraries of the city if an honorary fellowship in bibliography were established." The first fellow was Christopher Morley, who delivered the inaugural lecture in 1931. Since then, distinguished scholars have delivered lectures on a vast range of bibliographic topics, including 15th century printing, early American papermaking, the 18th century reading public, and the history of American rare book libraries. Because of the continuing commitment to the lecture series on the part of the University of Pennsylvania Press, many of the lectures have been printed by the press over the years. These volumes are held in high regard by those who study the history of books and printing. I'm very happy to report that through the good services of Eric Halperin and Jerry Singerman of the Penn Press, this year's lectures will be published as well. And with a nod to the inevitable intrusion of technology, I should point out that these will be the first Rosenbach lectures to be podcasted. Who can imagine what will come next? But I think that's probably enough background, and we ought to get to tonight's lecture. Introducing the 2007 Rosenbach Fellow is Professor Robert St. George, who is an associate professor of history here at Penn. His research focuses on American cultural history, material culture, and vernacular landscapes. He teaches courses in topics such as early American cultural history, witchcraft in the early modern world, public culture, and American consumer culture. He's a graduate of Hamilton College, the Winter Tour Program in Early American Culture at the University of Delaware, and he received his doctorate from Penn. So please welcome Professor Robert St. George.
Thank you. Well, it's my great pleasure. It's actually a sort of a happy pleasure, a great occasion to introduce David D. Hall, the Bartlett Professor at Harvard Divinity School. David is an individual whose high level of scholarship, fed by a sustained reading across disciplinary boundaries, an active international research and correspondent network, and an exacting use of historical evidence, has provided a beacon upon the several adjacent hills of intellectual history, the changing relationships of religious practice and social history, and the history of the book. While nominally we are gathered here this evening to consider this latter bookish historical subject, it finds some support, sustenance, and direction from some of his earlier work. David is a scholar's scholar, to be sure, and a teacher's teacher. Let me sketch just a few lines as one means of providing some scholarly context for his lecture this afternoon. We might start with some of his publications on reading, literacy, books, and publication. For example, consider just the geographic sweep of the first volume of the projected five-volume History of the Book in America, entitled The Colonial Book in the Atlantic World from the year 2000, a work that David co-edited with the late Hugh Amory, but one to which he contributed numerous essays, the introduction, his wonderful discussion and chapter on books, law, and publication in, quote, The Chesapeake in the 17th Century, another on readers and writers in early New England, and a final essay on learned culture in the 18th century. Or we may look at the material he gathered in Cultures of Print, Essays in the History of the Book from 1996, The Politics of Writing and Reading in 18th Century America, and Readers and Reading in America, Historical and Critical Perspectives are just two whose relevance to the Rosenbach lectures he's delivering seems clear. And now I also know the suspected source of the uses of literacy essay that fronts the entire book and establishes the flow and the feeling of the chapters that follow. How, though, are these subtle explorations of the circuitry of bookmaking, of book selling, and of book reading connected to any of David's earlier work? One clue comes from a third essay in the Cultures of Print volume, this one entitled The World of Print and Collective Mentality in 17th Century New England. Interpretive challenges concerning books and the politics of reading are embedded in the problem of collective consciousness, what David has variously termed popular culture and, when applicable, extended to popular religion. Students of early American cultural history know his Worlds of Wonder, Days of Judgment, popular religious belief in early New England, with its emphases on uses of literacy and ritual, and on the ways in which people make their own lay religious practice as doctrine and pulpit poetics collide with social anxieties, the challenges of childbirth, disease, and death, and inherited understandings drawn from various English regional backgrounds and their variegated, unregulated folklores. As David aptly phrased this shift in approach in one of his own study cellars, an essay called The Mental World of Samuel Sewall, first published in 1981, Sewall's religion is less a matter of textbook doctrine than of deeply felt responses to the great crises and rite de passage of human life. Crucially, popular culture was something that both the clergy and the laity shared, shifting its analysis from an easy contest between learned and low, or patrician and plebeian cultures. David's attention to popular belief and the popular reading of godly tracts is grounded, too, in a new way that he worked toward in thinking about religion. I remember first meeting David, I think, in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston at an August 1977 planning meeting for what became the New England Begins exhibition and catalog from 1982. I had already read his first monograph, The Faithful Shepherd, A History of the Ministry in the 17th Century, while a college junior before I met him. So when I landed in a meeting with him, I was already a fan. But what struck me a decade later was how his attention to the Massachusetts ministry in that first book became so radically broadened. the view of orthodoxy, its intellectual history pressed on all sides by the rising tide of a more inclusive social history, expanded to include what he called the new mediating ground. Excuse me, as he put it in an essay of 1984, and, quote, a range of possibilities, unquote, for a new kind of history of religion. It was into this and alongside this now more flexible vision of religious practice among various groups that David's interest in books and readings developed. And just when you think his chronological range is limited to the 17th or the 18th century, he'll back up to say something new about congregational polity in late 16th century London, or advance stunningly ahead a few centuries. David has long had an interest, and I gather worked sporadically, on the topic of cultural criticism in Victorian America. But the chapter, if any of you do not know it, on what he called the 70s to the present, in the second edition of Sidney E. Ahlstrom's A Religious History of the American People that Yale released in 2004, demonstrates the enormous temporal range that he brings to cultural history. In addition to all this scholarship, David is a teacher's teacher. He has advised a stream of remarkable dissertations and mentored countless younger scholars in the field. He played a pivotal role in establishing in the early 1970s the American and New England Studies program at Boston University. He has played the role of editor many times, both of important primary documents for use by students and scholars alike, and for gathering essays that together shape new ways of thinking about culture and society. He has, for example, edited the Antinomian Controversy, 1636 to 1638, and also Witch Hunting in 17th Century New England, a documentary history, 1638 to 1692. He's also edited the pathbreaking Lived Religion in America Toward a History of Practice that came out in 1997. And his Puritans in a New World, a critical anthology, is his response, perhaps, to the need for a teaching collection that finally updates Perry Miller and Thomas Johnson's The Puritans, a source book of their writings, first published in 1938. Finally, David has written wonderfully cogent introductions to other collections, to Printing and Society in Early America in 1983, to Understanding Popular Culture in 1984, and most recently to his colleague and friend Hugh Amory's posthumously published Bibliography and the Book Trades that Penn Press published in 2005. David's role as teacher is confirmed for us during his visit to Philadelphia. Tomorrow morning, Wednesday, he has agreed to meet with current Penn graduate students, faculty, and affiliates, including members of Penn's Seminar on the History of Material Texts and of the McNeill Center for Early American Studies. This gathering will be in the Lay Library right behind us here, through those doors, on the sixth floor of Van Pelt, and will begin at 10 a.m. You will all notice that a stapled handout of three sheets have been distributed on all chairs, and this will, I think, help to make sense, perhaps, of some of the things that David will talk about today. And he's also informed me that he's willing to consider and listen to any responses, any comments, as well as any questions for a short while following his presentation today. Please join me, then, in welcoming Professor David D. Hall, who will deliver his first Rosenbach lecture entitled Not in Print, Yet Published, The Significance of Scribal Publication. David.
When you hear an introduction as generous as that, and I thank you, Bob, for that generosity, and I thank you for our friendship of 30-odd years and also intellectual companionship, When you hear a review of your life like that, and you're getting to be an old dog, you say, can the old dog still do new tricks? And that's what I hope to do tonight. I should say that I often take the early phase of my career as an example of what not to do. Bob was very gentle in alluding to this. He referred to the rising tide of broader things than ministry. And indeed, my first monograph was published at the nadir of intellectual history and the nadir of institutional religious history. And I said to myself at a certain point, I don't really enjoy being part of the nadir any longer. I should say, too, that it's a tremendous honor to give these lectures, and I will have more to say by way of thanks on Monday, just to in order to get going here this afternoon. But I did notice that I'm actually was given a list of all the previous lectures, including a tremendous number of people from whom I have learned and benefited, including the two most recent lecturers. But I should say that I discovered that I'm the first American historian to actually have given these lectures, and so I hope this is not an occasion for being the last American historian. It might almost be, if you see the quality of your handout, because I wrote, I'm going to read what I wrote. I am still living in the age of the pen and press, and that I have never made the leap to PowerPoint. Now, my secretary and I brilliantly planned to send down by mail lovely, clear copies of the illustrations. They did not arrive. So this afternoon, she faxed some of them. Actually, better copies we hope will arrive tomorrow by FedEx. I'm almost into the FedEx age. And so what you have here, I'm going to comment on these right now, so get them out of the way. One of them, the second one, is an homage to Peter Stalybrass. Because Peter is fascinated by print to manuscript. And here is a gorgeous example. Simon Willard inherited a copy of his father's useful instructions. It was missing the last two pages. He borrowed another copy, and he wrote out the last two pages in handwriting. So, Peter, this is a gift to you to add to your collection. The first one relates to a part of the chapter on scribal publication that will come out in the Penn Book that I can't, unfortunately, get into tonight for want of time. And this is a title page to one of William Bradford's manuscripts. And Bradford, for those of you who don't know this, never published anything in print in his lifetime. He was a scribal writer par excellence, never published anything in print in his own lifetime, or actually under his own name in his lifetime. And the third is, unfortunately, not shown so well by the quality of the reproduction here, is the most gorgeous manuscript that I have come across from the 17th century. It's a manuscript written by the great magistrate and friend of the Native Americans, Daniel Gookin. He was the commissioner in Massachusetts for the local Indians. And this is a book-length history of the Indians that he prepared in 1674. This is probably not in his handwriting. It's almost certainly by a professional copyist. But you can see the immense care he took to fashion the title page. It's just a gorgeous manuscript book. I should say he falls into another category of people I cannot talk about tonight or even on Thursday, and that is those people who actually wanted to publish in print but didn't make it. And Daniel Gookin had clearly prepared this in the hope that someone would print it. It was not printed until the very end of the 19th century. My purpose in these lectures is to describe the work of making texts in England and New England, both sides of the Atlantic, but only by New England writers. Making texts is my theme. That is, looking at the stages, the steps that occur as a written text passed from a writer's desk out into the wider world. To understand this process in the 17th century means that we must take account of two different technologies of reproduction: the making of handwritten texts that circulated as manuscripts or scribal publication, and the far more familiar process of printing when texts were set in type and reproduced as printed books or broadsides or whatever. Today I focus on scribal publication, Thursday on printed texts, though both today and Thursday I'll actually be dealing with both technologies. There's no neat separation between the two. Next Monday I turn to a somewhat different subject, and again, both technologies figure, although especially scribal publication, and that is to explore with you some ways of connecting political life with text-making, political life, and especially the possibilities for dissent or criticism with text-making. There's so much to say about all three of these subjects, scribal, printed, and the politics of criticism. There's so much to say about all three that I've had to be arbitrary in choosing just a few examples from an immense set of possibilities. So today you will get to hear a great deal about the antinomian controversy. I didn't actually mean to let you all know that I had written a book about the antinomian controversy, or edited the documents of the antinomian controversy, because that, I'm going to put that to the side, although this is a corrective account of that documents. And then tonight, the antinomian controversy. Thursday, the career of John Cotton as a writer and publisher. And next Monday, we turn to, in the context of criticism and politics, to John Winthrop as my case study, also a scribal writer, but of course a deeply political writer. So now it's time to go back to the 17th century. And I begin with John Winthrop. John Winthrop is probably the most cited of all our 17th century writers. Evoked time and again because of his indispensable journal, and evoked even more frequently for having declared of the new colony he was helping to found, "We shall be as a city upon a hill," a sentence quoted by presidents and popes in recent time. A sentence that popes and presidents could quote was, however, a sentence that very few of the colonists would have encountered, for the text in which it appears, the model of Christian charity or charity discourse, was never printed in the 17th century. In fact, it wasn't printed until the mid-19th century. Nor would anyone other than a handful of deputies and magistrates in the Massachusetts General Court have known of Winthrop's little speech on liberty, a staple of modern-day anthologies of American Puritanism. And although he shared his journal with a few friends, the only version of the text, a manuscript in his own handwriting, would not be printed until the 1790s. When he died in 1649, his name had yet to appear on the title page of any printed book or pamphlet, though his was one of several names appended to the humble request of 1630, issued anonymously in London as the Winthrop fleet was setting sail for New England, and probably written by someone whose name was not identified. Retrospectively, he has been credited with a book of documents and commentary relating to the antinomian controversy, and I'll say more about the controversy, what it was, for those of you who are not aware, a short story of the rise, reign, and ruin of the late antinomians and familists, printed in London in 1644 without any attribution on the title page. But this was not a book he wrote, or so I will argue at a later point this afternoon. Nonetheless, Winthrop was a published author. Manuscript copies of the model, together with some of his letters, were circulating in the 1630s and 1640s. The model may have been the earliest of his writings to be published in this manner, for an English friend wrote Winthrop's son John Jr. in 1634 asking for a copy, a request that is understandable only if it had already been available in England. And we know now, by the way, this is not my discovery, that it was not written on board the Arbella, or probably even given on board the Arbella. 4 years later, in 1638, Roger Williams was thanking Winthrop for another text, a relation of the monster birth that the antinomian Mary Dyer had tried to conceal. And as he reported in his own journal, Winthrop arranged in the early 1640s for a political statement of his to be published, that is, distributed and made available in handwritten copies. As late as the early 18th century, texts of his were still being distributed in handwritten copies. For in 1714, the Boston-based magistrate Samuel Sewall asked a colonist living in England to transmit to a historian in England a copy of Governor Winthrop's notes of the election of 1637. These are excavated from his journal. Winthrop may seem unusual for having published entirely or nearly so in handwritten copies. But once we seek out other texts that circulated in this manner, his can be recognized as a common practice, so much so that among the colonists, scribal publication deserves a central place. Far from being unusual, scribal publication was an everyday event in 17th century New England. Winthrop and the many others, I've mentioned Bradford, I'll mention others before we're done here. Winthrop and the many others who employed this technology were not frustrated suitors of the book trades. Like their English contemporaries, who also relied on scribal publication, they recognized the quotidian utility of this mode and its advantages in particular situations. Not yet enclosed within modern-day assumptions about the revolutionary significance of printing and the eclipse of the manuscript tradition, the colonists knew of books that contained both printing and handwriting, a point Peter has made in his lectures and many times over in other contexts. Printed books interleave with blank pages so that readers could comment on or supplement the text, or as in the case of the illustration I've just shown you, a printed book from which missing pages have been supplied in manuscript, all of which imply that printing was an extension of handwriting, not something radically different. In everyday experience, moreover, the colonists constantly encountered texts that passed back and forth between printing and handwriting, two examples being elegies and proclamations. But mainly the colonists experienced scribal publication on its own terms, as a technology suited for certain forms of writing or certain kinds of communication. And I remind you here, by way of suggesting some of the social and communicative context here, that in 17th century New England, the practice of writing was closely bound up with the practice of speaking. I can make this point this way, that no New England printer from 1640 on, no New England printer printed any of the thousands of sermons preached in the 1640s and 1650s, the first 20 years of colonization in Massachusetts and Connecticut, except for two series by Richard Mather, published in the 1650s. Instead, in household after household, the substance of everyday preaching was preserved in handwritten notes that people treated with as much reverence as they did any printed book they owned, putting them to use in meetings like the one Anne Hutchinson convened in her Boston home in the mid-1630s to discuss the previous week's sermon. Down to the end of the century, the most important genre of religious instruction and the most practiced form of writing, comparable, the only thing to compare it to would be letters, that is, the sermon, was shared among the colonists either in speech or in handwriting. And I can give you the most cursory of inventories of other kinds of texts that were published in this manner, that for which scribal publication was singularly suited. Just a taste here. For example, documents associated with the workings of the civil government, sessions laws, law codes, proclamations, all of these were in manuscript up until a certain point. Poetry. There were dozens and dozens of versifiers in 17th century New England, and their primary mode of publication was in handwritten copies. And if you read carefully the introduction, the preface to Anne Bradstreet's published poems of 1650, The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up, you learn from her brother-in-law that the reason he took her manuscript to London to have it printed was precisely that handwritten copies were beginning to circulate and the family was losing control of the text. So he jumped that whole process to have them printed. every kind of petition and remonstrance and forms of protest, all of these in the 17th century, up until the very end of the 17th century, were done in manuscript copies. Spiritual biographies, spiritual autobiographies, and other kinds of documents of personal experience, these circulated in handwritten copies. Letters, I'll say a moment here more about letters. I have to pass by Quaker letters. The Quakers who came to the colonists issued an extraordinary number of letters, all of which circulated in handwritten copies, because, of course, they couldn't have been printed. And then histories as well, Bradford's history, Daniel Gookin's history, and others. Let me take as an illustration here of how this process worked, because I also want to address the question of distribution and reception. The production and distribution of letters that passed back and forth between New England and England in the earliest years of colonization. The documentary evidence is excellent for certain texts. As soon as the minister Francis Higginson had arrived in Salem in 1629, he gave the first ship to return a copy of A True Relation of the Last Voyage to New England, a tract that was in John Winthrop's hands by the fall in a manuscript copy, and that was widely shared among prospective colonists in the early 1630s. After Thomas Weld arrived in the summer of 1632, he wrote a letter to his former parishioners in Essex, extolling the wonders of religion in his new homeland, a letter so widely known in England that a copy reached the London furniture maker Nehemiah Wallington, a plebeian figure, who copied it into one of his many notebooks. And Wallington also preserved another letter that became famous on both sides of the Atlantic, Anthony Thatcher's account of a shipwreck in 1635 off Pemaquid Point and the hazards endured by the survivors. My favorite example is a letter John Cotton sent from England. We're now going to do the traffic the other way, from England to New England and back. A letter John Cotton sent from England in 1630 to Samuel Skelton, the minister in Salem, another minister in Salem, protesting his separatist, his radical Puritan-like actions. Cotton wanted this letter distributed in England. It wasn't really written to Skelton. It looked like it was written to Skelton, but he wanted it distributed in England in order to reassure moderate Puritans and perhaps the regime, perhaps the Stuart regime, that the Massachusetts Bay Company was not controlled by radical Puritans who were going to turn separatist once they reached New England. Remarkably, we can identify three recipients in the 1630s of this letter in England. And when Cotton came to Salem in 1636 to apologize for this letter — he, by the way, had now become a radical Puritan himself — to apologize for being so critical 6 years earlier, he remarked in passing that many in the town had their own copies of this letter. I cite these few examples as my way of assuring you that scribal publication mattered. It made a difference. And it made a difference because, although at its point of origin no handwritten text was reproduced in more than a dozen or 15 copies, or there's, in one case I know of, 19, any or all of these copies could prompt the making of more copies in the course of time. There's no way to stop the chain, to know when the chain of reproduction would come to an end. Now, let me pose a few questions that we're going to carry over to Thursday's lecture as well. Every handwritten text was problematic. So, of course, are printed texts, as we will see on Thursday. There was one difference between handwritten and printed texts, and that is that no one who engaged in scribal publication ever complained about booksellers being a pack of thieves, which happens again and again with those who are publishing in print. After all, no manuscript text in New England ever had any commercial value, at least to my knowledge. Even so, a question that came up again and again was whether a manuscript copy was accurate or corrupt. A second question, a related question, had to do with authorship, anonymity, and attribution. How were handwritten texts assigned to authors if no name was specified? And why did some texts remain anonymous? Then there's the aspect described of publication that has to do with the terms private and public, a space, I'll argue here in just a moment, filled far more by handwritten texts than those that were printed, the space between the private and the public. And finally, there's the question of whether a text was authorized or illicit, orthodox or subversive, official or seditious. Were handwritten texts censured, or did they fall outside the usual mechanisms of control? Of these, alas, I have time only to talk about two, namely the question of private and public, and then the question of accuracy of copies. The distinction between writings deemed public and those deemed private was, in my judgment, immensely significant for handwritten texts, all of which were situated in close proximity to the idea and practice of privacy. The power of this distinction, the power of this idea, or we might even say practice, resonates in John Cotton's dismay that Roger Williams, in London in 1644, had published in print a letter of his. And Cotton writes to Williams, "The letter, and so the error contained in it," it was also, he complained, a very badly copied text that Williams had used, "the letter, and so the error contained in it, it was private, and so private that I know no man that hath a copy of it, no, not myself who penned it, for aught I could find, but himself only." Private, immensely meaningful to Cotton. It was meaningful, too, to Anne Hutchinson, who, when she confronted a group of ministers who wanted to know if she was really criticizing them, as rumor had it, telling them that they were no good, she said, and they wanted to bring this evidence into court, she said it was a private conversation and the evidence could not be brought into court. The same term resonates in Cotton Mather's anger that Robert Califf outed him by publishing in 1700 another brand plucked from the burning, Mather's manuscript account of a young girl's recovery from diabolic possession. And on the manuscript copy it says, "Please return to me, Cotton Mather." He didn't know that Califf was going to pilfer this, copy it, and print it. The distinction appears, too, of course, in the preface to Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God, where private and public are gendered. Namely, Rowlandson should not be speaking in public because she's a woman, except that certain circumstances make it viable for her now to be appear in public, namely framed by a male writer. And then there's the context as well, the power, the appeal of the term private, and therefore the appeal of scribal publication, has a great deal to do with the sense among 17th century writers that to make themselves public by publishing in print was to be, and this is a verb they will use again and again, was to be exposed to the possibilities of criticism and censure. To write in private, to publish in private scribally, was to avoid the unpleasant consequences of being exposed. And finally, there's the context which I think in the end means the most of all, namely the colonists' aversion to conflict and the high value they placed on social peace, one consequence of which was a very considerable reluctance to wash their dirty linen in public. Some of you may remember the passage in Winthrop's Journal, it's early on in Winthrop's Journal, when the very small group of magistrates in the colony in Massachusetts are at each other's throats. They can't agree on anything. They hate each other. But at the end of the day, and Winthrop tells us this, they decided not to say anything to anyone of their disagreements, but to appear in public as though they were in harmony. And in the early 1640s, we'll hear more about this on Monday, when conflict again had engulfed the Massachusetts General Court, and there was no consensus, there was no peace, the deputies stepped back from publishing something, and the magistrates say, "Well, we better not publish," and this was their reason, the apprehension that if it were published, it would cause a public breach throughout the country, and if it should come to that, the people would fall into factions. So again, I evoke these various contexts to remind you of the immense power of a distinction that will impinge on the public and the private. I should say, and these are lessons I've learned from some of you here in this audience, I should say that to prohibit something is, of course, to make it more delicious, more attractive. And so Roger Williams published John Cotton's private letter. And Cotton Mather wrote a letter condemning one of the governors of the colony. This is early in the 18th century. And he tells his English correspondent, "Okay, you can distribute this private letter if you think it would do some good to damage this governor." And then Winthrop has a really delicious passage when he refers to a letter that he has received, and I quote, "It was directed to myself first, but came to me through many hands, and so it seems to have been intended by you being sent unsealed, the art of sending a private letter that you actually want to have made public." So private and public are never absolute categories. There's a marvelous tension between the two that in certain moments, in certain times, people can exploit. I'm going to pass by the question of copies and how authentic they were, because I'll turn to that here in a moment with the antinomian controversy, and let me turn directly to the controversy. I turn to it because these questions of authenticity and attribution of the public and the private, the revealed and the concealed, are so much a part of the textual history, the publication history of the controversy. Here we encounter not only the ethics of privacy, but its close kin, the practice of self-censorship. Here we encounter texts that were anonymous, and that in some sense to this day remain anonymous. And here we come upon assertions that a manuscript has been altered for political reasons, that is, that it is corrupt, and where we can actually demonstrate, thanks to survivals, that the same versions of a text are, in fact, that different versions of a text are, in fact, different in significant ways. And here also we can follow the passage of manuscript texts into print, a process that brings into view certain practices of the book trades, and especially the agency of collaborators or intermediaries, a theme that I'll linger on more fully on Thursday. I want to pay particular attention to a printed book I've already mentioned, a short story, and I'll call it just a short story from here on out, of 1644, credited to John Winthrop, because I can now, I think, trace how this book came into being. The antinomian controversy originated in two separate but related critiques of how religion, true religion, was being taught and practiced among the colonists in 1635, 36, 37. John Cotton, first among equals in New England, was complaining by the mid-1630s, not long after he arrived, that the colonists were relying on sanctification for assurance of salvation. Meanwhile, Anne Hutchinson, a remarkable woman in his congregation, an educated woman, was warning in private meetings, and I quote, that constraining to all known duties, was no more but legal work, which is to say, not the way of grace. The two had an ally in the minister, John Wheelwright, and another in Henry Vane, a young Englishman of aristocratic rank, who was elected the governor of the colony in May 1636. And I should mention that most of the church members in Boston, at least for a while, shared their point of view. In the late fall and early winter of 1636, after the other ministers realized how critical of them Hutchinson, and they thought also Cotton, was, efforts were made to restore consensus. Some of the ministers met with Anne Hutchinson. Others met with Cotton. And then in January 1637 came an event that brought all these hopes for consensus to an end when John Wheelwright declared in a fast day sermon that the whole country was divided between two ranks, some under a covenant of grace, and these were friends to Christ, others under a covenant of works, these were enemies to Christ. At the next meeting of the General Court, he was charged with heresy. That charge was dropped, and then they were charged with sedition, a step that prompted many in the Boston church to sign a petition protesting. Winthrop replaces Vane as governor in May. In September, the ministers hold a special synod, and in November, the General Court punishes Wheelwright, Hutchinson, and their supporters by fines, exile, disarming, and the like. And it goes on until early 1638 in other ways. During a year and a half of argument, protest, and negotiation, every text thrown up by the controversy unfolded within the limitations and possibilities of scribal publication. And publish is the operative verb, for we have it on John Winthrop's authority that in December or January of 1636-37, quote, many copies, unquote, were made of certain texts and dispersed about. And some months later, he noted for a second time that diverse writings were published. But the principal evidence of scribal publication lies in the number of manuscript copies that survive, or that contemporaries mentioned as having read, or that secretaries or scribes reported having made. Ignoring letters and the general run of sermons, I count at least 25 texts that were published in handwritten copies by early 1638. None of these could have been printed in Massachusetts for the simple reason that the printing office in Cambridge was not set up until late 1639. But whether any should be printed in England, as several eventually were, was already a divisive question in 1637. Divisive because the winners, and by the end of the fall, one party had clearly won, namely the legal party, because the winners realized that winning could also mean losing if news reached England of just how bitterly divided the colonists had been and how much John Cotton was implicated in the affair. Divisive, too, because of the very persistent ambivalence to which I've already made reference about what should be made public and what should be made kept private. And divisive, too, because of uncertainties about the authority of handwritten copies. That some documents would make their way to England and come into the hands of intermediaries who wanted them printed was, in retrospect, inevitable. Indeed, the history of scribal publication is in part a history of documents that circulated just below the radar for a while and then passed over into the hands of the book trades, that slipped out of someone's control and were made eventually public by being printed. At first, as I say, there was ambivalence about this question among the leaders of the colony. And a letter survives from Thomas Hooker, one of the major ministers then in Hartford, a letter written in April of 1637 to his son-in-law, Thomas Shepherd, the minister in Cambridge, and by the way, the number one hater of John Cotton. And he was a good hater, Thomas Shepherd, the number one hater of John Cotton. I'll refer to him again on Thursday. I actually liked Thomas Shepherd, but he was a very good hater. Though Thomas Hooker says in this letter that he's worried about the damage that news of the controversy would cause in England, he wondered if, and it's a fascinating adjective he uses, he wondered if naked publication, as he put it, would serve to counteract and correct the flow of rumor. He was realistic about any efforts at preserving secrecy. "My present thoughts run to this," he wrote Shepherd, "that such conclusions," here he means the opinions of Cotton and Hutchinson, "that such conclusions which are most extra, most extraneous and cross to the common current, send them over to the godly, learned, to judge in our own country," in other words, damn them by their own words, "and return their apprehensions. I suppose the issue will be more uncontrollable. If any should suggest this was the way to make the clamor too great and loud and to bring a prejudice upon the plantations, I should soon answer, there is nothing done in corners here, but it is openly there related. And in such notorious cases which cannot be kept secret, the most plain and naked relation ever causeth the truth more to appear. So here is a prominent person arguing, go public, now, seize the initiative. What happened is this, with the text to which he was referring, which happens to be a collection of 16 questions the ministers gave Cotton and Cotton's answers to these questions. What happened is this. One copy ended up in the papers of Samuel Hartlib, the great mid-17th century English intellectual, and is preserved there to this day. Another copy came into the hands of a layperson in Windsor, Connecticut. And still another came into the hands of a London bookseller. But of this, more in a moment. I pass by the really remarkable story, again for want of time, of John Wheelwright's sermon and how it was transmitted and reproduced. Two manuscript copies survive to this day, contemporary copies survive to this day. And turn now to the oddest text of the controversy and the first to be printed, a description of the deformed fetus born to the antinomian Mary Dyer in October of 1637, but not discovered and exhumed until the early spring of 1638. One version of this description was printed in London in 1642 as news from New England of a most strange and prodigious birth. The London bookseller attributed the text to a gentleman of good worth now resident in England. This, of course, is dust in your eyes. Well before this date, manuscript descriptions had been circulating in both England and New England, descriptions that were almost certainly John Winthrop's doing. For in April 1638, Roger William thanked him for a copy, and a brief manuscript version that survives in the Public Record Office in London concludes, I saw the monster and do affirm the relation to be true, John Winthrop, gent. But the broader English reading public first learned of the controversy from a book that was printed in January of 1644 and the significant editions in April 1644, The Short Story, to use the title of the revised edition. So too in 1644, the 16 questions with Cotton's answers came out, and 2 years later, another set of answers to questions that he had written. Each of these texts is problematic, for each is encircled with questions of attribution and authenticity, questions that return us to the handwritten manuscripts of the 1630s. Nothing is certain about the short story. Who put the book together? Who transcribed the manuscripts? Who warranted the text as being authentic? Or how they were transmitted to England? Materially, the short story is a London bookseller's attempt to dispose of unsold sheets from a previous printing of these texts entitled Antinomians and Familists Condemned. I'll shorten the title here. Neither version, the January version or the April version, the longer version is the April version, but I'll say more in a moment here, tell us who the author was or make any attribution, provide any errata, any dedications or the like. The second, however, the April version, the short story, begins with a to the reader by someone who tells us that having encountered the January version newly come forth in the press, he asked the bookseller if he could perfect it by laying down the order and sense of this story, which in the book is omitted, and by offering some additions to the conclusions. This person identified himself as T.W., and at the close of the introduction, as T. Weld, namely the same Thomas Weld whose letter of 1632 I mentioned a moment ago. And Weld had returned to England in 1641 as an agent of the Massachusetts government. Weld tells us nothing about the sources of the short story. He made no attribution. He offered no assurances of authenticity. Well aware that many in Parliament and the Westminster Assembly and in the wider English public regarded the colonists as crazy, he wrote with two goals in mind: to give readers some context for what they would discover in the short story, and to place all the blame for the controversy on two people, Anne Hutchinson and John Wheelwright. We owe to him the tagline of Jezebel that has followed Anne Hutchinson around ever since. And we owe to him as well the dark vision of the antinomians as Latter-day Anabaptists bent on turning the world upside down. Not once, talk about self-censorship, not once did Weld mention John Cotton or the young English aristocrat Henry Vane, who by now was a rising power in Parliament, good reason not to mention him. So the short story begins with distorted rhetoric and self-censorship. What else is in the book? And an ending, by the way, that renews this rhetoric that Weld had added. What else is in the book? It contains four documents. The proceedings of the Senate of 1637, when the ministers put together a list of 82 errors and 9 unsavory speeches, each followed by a confutation. The proceedings of the General Court, which John Wheelwright is condemned and others were condemned. The most famous document is the examination of Mrs. Hutchinson at the same court meeting when ministers and magistrates questioned her and she ends up offering her so-called revelation. And then fourth is a brief apology in defense of the general proceedings of the court against John Wheelwright. That's in the first edition of January and in the second edition of April, the same sheets. And to these four documents, Weld himself added a copy of the Mary Dyer Monster Birth Story and a brief account of the church trial of Anne Hutchinson and her death in 1643. He updated the story. How did these documents come into being, especially the first three? And who assembled them in a package? To this question, happily, a long overlooked letter provides a satisfying answer. And when I say satisfying, to me it's personally satisfying because I overlooked this letter. I overlooked this letter in 1967, 40 years ago, when I was editing the documents, and only recently have I rediscovered it. Not the first discovered, but rediscovered for my own purposes. So here it goes. And it's a fascinating letter. In May 1643, the young minister John Higginson wrote a dunning letter to the Massachusetts General Court asking for payment for services he had provided 6 years earlier in 1637. He began by reminding the court of what he had been hired to do back in 1637. I was employed by the magistrates and ministers at the synod held in Cambridge 1637 to take in shorthand all that then passed. At the end of it, I was desired to draw up a copy of all the material passages that it might be printed for public use, which so far as it did belong to me after the expense of so much time and pains on my part was done. The expense of time had apparently been considerable, for it was not until May of 1639, almost 2 years later, that Higginson had actually given the General Court his manuscript. Record. What happened thereafter is critical to an understanding of the scribal history of the controversy, for the court ordered, and again I'm quoting from Higginson's letter, because he was telling all of this in his letter, that the minister should have the viewing of it, and that then it should be printed. And then he says, and this is utterly fantastic, I mean unreal, that I should have the benefit of the printing of it for my pains, it being then conceded it would amount to about £100. That I would earn from having this book published. When I say fantastic, I mean John Milton was getting £5 or £10 for his book at the same time. So this fantastic bargain to be, I mean, there was no possibility that the local printer was going to cough up £100 for the printing of this text, or any English printer, was also cause for uneasiness in Higginson himself. Because the magistrates had stipulated that no damage might arise from the publication, either to the cause or the country. And Higginson worries that he is going to be the cause of trouble if he actually arranges for this text to be printed. Then comes the next stage. This is a long letter. I left it, he tells the court, with the hands of the ministers for a while who had the viewing of it. And then they divided. Some were for it. Yet others were against it, conceiving it might possibly be an occasion of further dispute and differences both in this country and other parts of the world, whereupon they voted not to have it printed. Now, poor Higginson is trying to drop the other shoe. I have yet to be paid for my labors. And this marvelous fantasy of earning £100 has not come true. Will you please pay me for making these documents? He asks for a cash payment of £50, a figure he regarded as what the manuscript would have sold for, presumably, to the English trade. He's lowered his price here. Here, then, is one mystery solved. The source of the first of the texts in the short story, namely the account of the synod. To me, it seems virtually certain. I feel confident that the second and third texts, the proceedings of the general court and the examination of N. Hutchinson, came into being by the same or similar route. Indeed, I think it likely that Higginson was the record keeper on all three occasions. For the task of writing up the 82 errors and 9 unsavory speeches was certainly not worth £100, even if he were asked to make several copies. And he also, we know, had an assistant in the person of the young minister, Giles Furman. Certainly we know, thanks to later quotations in the 17th century, that there had come into being by the end of 1637, and I'm quoting now from a late 17th century source, a book or manuscript in which is all their proceedings. In which is all their proceedings. And this is a book in which Higginson, for sure, had some hand. Who then wrote the short story? To whom should we attribute the short story? There is only one sensible answer to this question. It is to treat it, the printed book of April 1644, to treat the printed book of 1644 as a composite text, three of which have no author at all. The declarations of the synod, the report of Mrs. Hutchinson's examination, and the proceedings of the general court, and the fourth, the defense of the general court, is, according to Winthrop in his journal, a collaborative effort by the magistrates as a whole, although often it is attributed to Winthrop without noting what he himself said about its origins. The short story, then, is not a book with an author. And all of you go back and look in your card catalogs and see that it's attributed to John Winthrop. Please tell your librarians to modify those cards or those entries in their digital computers. It's also a book surrounded by questions of accuracy, as are other texts in the controversy. For example, in March of 1637, John Wheelwright and his friends were protesting that the magistrates and ministers who were urging his censure, this is after he'd given that fast day sermon, were using an incomplete and inadequate version of the fast day sermon, a text fashioned, Wheelwright complained, out of broken notes taken by others, and they were ignoring what he had given them, a complete copy of the sermon. The examination of Anne Hutchinson exists in two versions, a long version that Thomas Hutchinson, her great-great-grandson, would print in the late 18th century, and a shorter version that appears in the short story. And although there are many similarities between these two texts, they are also significantly different. And then, of course, there's Winthrop's own journal and his account of the controversy. And as others have pointed out before me, his account of the controversy is marked by extraordinary acts of suppression, self-censuring, hiding what happens. For example, he never mentions John Wheelwright's fast day sermon, although presumably he was there on the occasion. And finally, thanks to the survival of certain manuscripts, we can show that the printed text of the 16 questions, and I will show you on Thursday John Cotton's corrections on the printed text that survives. The printed copy of the 16 questions is full of mistakes of a certain kind. So then the controversy, as I say, is marked by texts for which there are uncertainties of attribution, uncertainties of authenticity, and above all, uncertainties as to whether they should be made private or public. Many actually did remain private, but the key texts came out in public in the 1640s to the shame of the colonists. Those of you who know the story more fully than I've been able to relate here know that immediately that the short story was printed, as soon as it was printed, the Scotch Presbyterian, Robert Bailey, seized upon it and used it to discredit everybody in New England, especially poor John Cotton. He claimed that John Cotton and Mrs. Hutchinson were like this, and then John Cotton had to write an anguished response denying that he was a close friend of Anne Hutchinson's. Let me conclude. The very, very good literary historian Arthur Marotti has referred to scribal publication as a system. Yet for me, scribal publication is always, at least in the New England context, contingent and provisional, framed and bounded by questions that also arise about printed texts of authenticity and attribution, and framed also by questions of private and public, deeply provisional also in the sense that so often they are going to slip out of control, someone's control, and pass over into being printed texts. There's nothing certain about a scribal text. Many did remain private, but always and everywhere there's the risk, the possibility, the tantalizing possibility to them, people at the time, that they would suddenly become public. Secondly, to answer the questions about authenticity and accuracy, it's not a question that can be answered systemically. There's no systemic answer to the question of is a scribal text accurate or authentic or to whom it should be attributed. My own experience suggests to me that we have to go text by text to find out the evidence. For some, it's easy. For others, there is still debate about who wrote a particular text. This is especially true of poetry. And I should say, finally, because I review one of the possibilities of these lectures is to encourage those of you who are young, everybody's young these days, those of you who are young, that there's still great possibilities for work to be done in the early New England field. And I should just report to you that everywhere I turn these days, it's maddening, because everywhere I turn, I find new copies. I stumble upon new examples of scribal publication, of texts that circulated scribally. And this is something I did not know about 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, and I'll say more about that on Monday. But I mentioned, just remind you that Anne Bradstreet can be viewed in part as a scribal writer. William Bradford, whom I mentioned earlier, is entirely a scribal writer. The great Connecticut conservative of the end of the 17th century, early 18th century, Gershom Buckley, is a scribal writer with one exception. Manuscripts remain unstudied. Benjamin Thompson, the most important poet of his time in the late 17th century, a scribal writer. Edward Taylor, of course, supremely a scribal writer, although he did actually print two poems. The Mathers, intermittently, are scribal writers. And then there's the case of John Winthrop, the perfect scribal writer. But I have to save that story for another lecture. Thank you very much. So draw a breath, stretch, time for a stretch here, and yes, who's taping this? Should I stay by the microphone? Or can I come around? My instinct is to come around front, but anyway, I have to stay by the microphone, I can see. Sir? Yes, you, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Since it was an accepted practice to copy letters, do you have any examples of malicious changes that caused ruptures or caused problems, and maybe in later history?
Yeah, I don't. One exception, which is not quite the, and that is, it's a famous case in Matheriana, and that is that Increase Mather was in the 1680s was opposed to the royal government that had been imposed on Massachusetts, the Dominion of New England. And his enemies forged a letter with his name on it, and this was exposed, I think, late in the 19th century as a forged letter, meaning to get him into further trouble, further doo-doo by circulating this letter in handwritten copies. That's the only example that I know of a deliberate forgery of a letter, and a handwritten letter, to make some of it. I don't know of examples, maybe Bob would or others know, of letters that were then true letters that were, your question is about true letters, were they altered, and I don't know of a specific example.
I didn't mean
forgery. I jumped categories to a forgery, because I don't know of, but it's certainly there as a tempting possibility to happen. Yes, Roz.
Earlier in your talk, you you use the expression technology of publication, and I wonder if you could explain that a little bit when talking about handwriting.
Yeah, the really great historians of scribal publication in England, Peter Beale, Harold Love, Arthur Moratti, Woodhuysen, and others have addressed significantly the question of hands and what hand a text was written, the kinds of penmanship and pens that were used, and the concrete materialities of scribal publication. And secondly, they've also addressed the question of professional copyists, the scriveners who were making copies. And this is where I'm like the Luddite of scribal publication. I'm probably not going to go there because I'm not trained to do that kind of work. I'm not trained to do that kind of work. We do know, thanks to Sergeant Bush's superb edition of Cotton's letters, that most of his letters are actually written by someone else in someone else's hand. So Cotton had a clerk in his own house. His correspondence was of such extent that he had a young man in his own house who was doing copies. And we know, of course, Thomas Letchford was a professional scrivener in Massachusetts, and we can point to a few other people of this kind. Again, Bob St. George would know as much, if not more, about this than I would. So there are techniques for making copies. One of the interesting questions is, and maybe someone else here could answer, maybe Peter can answer it, is how often the copyist compared the copy back to the original, whether they just chugged on and kept going. And I have yet to encounter a manuscript which shows that someone has compared it to the presumed original. But that must have happened in many cases. The other interesting technology, I left it out of my talk tonight, is, of course, state documents, where you have a clerk who says vera copia, and you have a seal, and you have very specific indications of authenticity on it. It doesn't mean that those are all exactly alike. For example, all the copies of the Mayflower Compact or of the Massachusetts Charter, each one of them varies from another. If you look at the printed versions and manuscript versions, even though they might carry vera copia or be signed at the bottom. But there are systems in the technology of reproduction, there are systems of authenticating certain kinds of documents that are absent for other kinds of documents. But this may be taking me away from where you wanted me to go with your question.
No, I think that's where I want to go, but I think that part of the question is what the distinction between manuscripts that people are just writing letters and those that really are intended to be scribally published.
Right. That's a very, very good question. And it's not a hard, and my soft answer would be there's no hard and fast distinction between those two. The Gookin text is, as I say, a gorgeous example of a professional clerk's handwriting, but it probably is something that he hoped to have printed, and that's why it was of that quality. Let me just, as I say, it would take me too long to give a really long answer to your question, but let me just give you one example. There's a young man in Plymouth, 16-year-old man named John Willett, who William Bradford dies in 1657, and that same year John Willett, somebody assigned him to make a copy of the very, very extensive poetry that Bradford left in manuscript at his death. He actually mentions it in his will. He assigns it by name, by title, to his executors, not to have it published, printed, just mentions it as something that's valuable to hold on to. And John Willett, somehow or other, was dragged into making copies of these poems, and they survive, as does Bradford's own handwritten version of part of one of them. So you can compare his version with Willett's version. And Willett's version is a sad, sad mess of Bradford's version. His literacy is erratic. His attention span was short. He had no feeling for the graphics of poetry. For example, all the spacing of stanzas collapses. It's all just bled together, and so on and so forth. Yet it's the only version we have of most of this poetry. So it's a semi-lettered person being asked by someone to make copies. So it's that's why I say it's not a the wider field would show every possible variation, I think, on copyist practices. Yes, sir. And you in the blue, bluish, light blue tie there.
You mentioned in passing that there wasn't a market for these scribal publications of buying and selling, even though there are, you know, professional copyists involved. This strikes me as very odd in some ways, given, you know, printing was such a commercial operation.
Well, there is in England, and that's I'm implicitly working comparatively here again and again, ways I probably didn't make specific. For example, the famous example in England are the so-called separates that were reporting on parliamentary proceedings, and people subscribe for these, and also the handwritten news sheets. So there is a considerable market in England for handwritten copies. And but I can't yet identify any manuscript produced in New England as a manuscript circulating that for people. Which now, Thomas Letchford in Boston, when he was writing out somebody's will or a deed, he of course charged for that. That's in the commercial end of this process. If we're talking about literary or personal or controversial writings, which is what I'm really focusing on here. But you're right. It's quite a significant difference from the English practice. By the very end of the 17th century, there is someone in Boston writing news sheets and charging for them, and then that leads to the first newspaper of 1704. Let me move it around just a little bit for you, Peter.
What you're talking about most of the time, or all the time, is the very specific kind of privacy, which is the privacy of public people. Not inevitably, but it seems to me that if you're talking about politics, that it doesn't have quite the same meaning as it might in different circumstances. And I'm thinking about, an extreme example of that kind of privacy would be the notion of the Privy Council, or the Privy Chamber, within a monarchical setup. Privacy has all the meanings of a very particular kind of power. And it's the ability to actually control the circulation, try to control the circulation of knowledge within a very specific elite. And I just think that's very different from the notion of privacy in the sense that it might be used to mean someone who's not political at all and therefore actually is outside, in which case the question of whether they're public or not doesn't really even arise. It's not of interest, why would anyone know about it?
Terrific point.
So the people you're talking about, it's a bit odd, it's a bit kind of privacy. It's privacy.
Right. Terrific point. It's a very, very good point. And it's one that will come back up on Monday, and I will incorporate your point. Because I do talk on Monday, we'll talk on Monday about the culture of secrecy and how the regime tries to control what is made public and so forth and so on. I did suggest that private covers a range of things. So you're helping sharpen the different possibilities for the uses of the term private, the label private, and what kinds of documents it would apply to. I think that my only slight pushback would be that in the particular Protestant vernacular culture of New England, the text that we might think of as private, namely, for example, accounts of spiritual experience, did circulate. They were seen as valuable. So, for example, Joseph Eliot writes a letter of spiritual counsel to his brother, and Thomas Prince tells us that they knew of 5 manuscript copies. It's one of these many times over. This is in the early 18th century. This is 3/4 of a century later. He has 5 manuscript copies. I could give other examples, but not for want of time here. So there's the political, in your sense of the term, political, but in this particular culture, other kinds of texts that are personal texts were still also deemed important and shared around. But you're quite right, it's important to make distinctions here along maybe not a spectrum, but places around, points along a circle or something of that sort. Is that a fair response to your question? Yes.
The talk brings to mind 2 other examples of such scribal writing from vastly different time periods. The first example is a practice in early America, and a practice which began and continued in Europe up until the Second World War, of students taking careful notes of famous professors and lectures, and either circulating them themselves in manuscript form, or very often getting together with other students collating several different versions of each lecture, and then, after many years, publishing these lectures in printed form as an homage to the professor. This is mainly in the physical sciences, and these books or manuscripts became very important in the academics of life in Europe and America. And of course, the other example that I want to bring up is Samizdat, which has some of the same problems that you alluded to here.
Yes, the first is an immensely rich subject. Just to supplement it and then tell a story. Supplement it. There were no student textbooks at Harvard College until it's printed textbooks in use until the 1730s. Every textbook was copied in hand by the students. So not only is it lecture notes, it's also textbooks themselves. Actually, when Edward Taylor was leaving Harvard to go out to the rather lonely, barren little village of Westfield, he made copies of a bunch of books by handwriting, so he'd have something to read when he was out there. I should just add to your story that I taught the American Survey at UCLA for my pains in 1989, and they survived somewhere in the great archives of the world. My lecture notes copied over by somebody and sold at UCLA, from which I earned nothing whatsoever.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that at the outset, when you were talking about the fact that once, let's say, seven Scribal copies exist, and then each one might have a chain beyond it, so that the laws of control that might affect all of that body of material have to be factored in as a Scribal loss of control, in a sense that operates beneath the loss of control in the ideal sense of the critique of the press. So it's a kind of, ranges of loss, or ranges of politics about that issue.
Right, exactly. And actually, I think when I, a question that I'll dwell a little bit on Thursday, and in conclusion, the word control may even be the wrong word. That is to say, we need to turn this around. It's like the word authentic. You know, you see Shakespeare's publishers say authentic copy. Well, it's just whatever they had their hands on. And to try to recover the sense at the time of what control would mean, and I'll talk more about this on Thursday, what authentic may mean. So your comment pushes me in that direction, to actually abandon the word control altogether and treat it as something that everyone, as Thomas Hooker says to Shepherd, there really is no control over any of this stuff. That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, in a sense, it's there in terms of keeping it private, but it's the way that Hooker was talking to Shepherd, or that Higginson talks about the ministers debating whether to publish it or not, make it public or not. But it's, we have to be very, very careful that we don't slide over into authorial control or some other form of control which is not so operative for them. You're telling me it's time for the reception.
I'm just going to suggest
yes.
That it's time
yes.
to move from public yes. to private discourse with our speaker. There's a reception here. Speak with him there, and please come back on Thursday. Thank you.
Thank you.